Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. Opening the show tonight was a snippet from one of my favorite groups that hails from Las Vegas, Nevada. They're called Zen Gaia, and that cut was Breath of Passion. If you liked it too, definitely check them out. That's Zen Gaia. I don't know about you, but whenever I hear that, I just feel like I'm transported back to maybe another lifetime, and I'm a priestess on her way to the Isis temple in Philae, Egypt, dressed in all my regalia, and I'm on the back of this camel, and it's just sort of loping along, you know, that's the camel gait that they have. You know, the melody just does all of that for me. You know, I'm on back that camel. Well, anyway, bringing me back to the present. With Father's Day approaching, I wanted to just put this out there. I wonder how many of you were thinking what a wonderful opportunity to open a dialogue about visioning what men's roles for the future might be. Maybe you can talk about men of the future being men of partnership and negotiation rather than domination and control. Men who value women and revere sacred sexuality, who believe women should be equal and share in the abundance Goddess offers rather than doing most of the work on the planet while only owning less than 20% of the assets. Yes, men who are inclusive. These are the Renaissance men of the paradigm shift. I think I should probably copyright that phrase, Renaissance men of the paradigm shift. These men who aren't afraid to nurture, who understand the importance of a cooperative spirit, who embrace the us and the we instead of the I and the me. Men like Matthew Fox, Father Roy Bourgeois, my awesome husband Roy of 27 years, and tonight's guest, Paul Smith, people like that who are willing to stand up, be counted for ideals of the sacred feminine, for change, you know, what's best for the most of us. Just some food for thought as Father's Day approaches. Bring it up at the dinner table or at the restaurant when you take Dad out for dinner. And email me. Tell me how that goes. Well, tonight I have two great guests for you, as always. First up, as I mentioned already, Reverend Paul Smith. He's going to be with us tonight. He's the co-pastor at Broadway Church in Kansas City, Missouri. We're going to chat about his two books. His older book is called Okay to Call God Mother, and Integral Christianity, that's the new one, The Spirit's Call to Evolve, which is calling for a more inclusive perspective within the church that allows for spiritual paths beyond Christianity, such and the, you know, the Abrahamic religions, such as Buddhism, Wicca, and, of course, Goddess spirituality. Then in the second half of the show, I'll introduce you to Sarah Beek. The New York Times called her one of the new role models for her generation. She's the author of The Red Book, A Deliciously Unorthodox Approach to Igniting Your Divine Spark, and the forthcoming book, Red Hot and Holy, A Heretic's Love Story. That's my kind of girl. I can't wait to talk to Sarah. Aren't these two guests just perfect for my show? Because we're anything but traditional here. I love pushing the envelope because that envelope needs to be pushed and pushed hard sometimes. No wonder one of the show's mottos are the words of Gandhi. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. But before we begin, just a little bit of housekeeping, and then we'll get to my wonderful guests. Paul is there waiting on the line. I appreciate his patience. First, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate. I want to introduce myself to you. I'm the author of the two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and the second, it's bookend, as I like to think of it, because one's very left brain, the other's more right brain. Second one's called Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Both teach you to lead a goddess-inspired life, whether you're learning about goddess around the world, traveling to her sites, or you just want to know why the sacred feminine, deity, archetype, and ideal is still relevant today, maybe more so than ever. And I invite you to check out my website, KarenTate.com. Learn more about my books, classes, Sacred Sunday services held every fourth Sunday in North Hollywood. Don't miss the free meditations there. They're my gift to you, my listeners. And remember, please, Blog Talk is not free to host, and your contributions are welcome. And a shout of thanks goes out to Chris from Gaia Fest. Thanks, Chris, for that contribution to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Listeners might not realize that hosts pay out of our pockets to give guests a platform to teach and share their wisdom. So there are PayPal buttons on my Goddess store page if you'd like to make a credit card contribution, or you can always send a check. That works too. Any amount, no matter how small, because it all adds up. You can always email me at KarenTate108@ca.org.com. And I'm open to a regular sponsor. Maybe your group or publishing company would like a sponsor. You can do it for a month at a time or two or three. Maybe you have an event coming up and you'd like to advertise, because I'm starting to do commercials for the like-minded. So contact me if you're interested in chatting about the possibility. Also, if you're in Southern California, please don't forget, I keep reminding you because it is just so awesome, the Aphrodite, Demeter, and Persephone exhibit is there at the Getty Museum in Malibu for a bit longer. I honestly can't think of a better way to spend a Sunday afternoon than at a temple of goddess overlooking her marvelous Pacific Ocean. The views there, the gardens, the fountains, the settings are just unsurpassed. And also, we've just scheduled our annual Isis birthday salon and feast for July 15th. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that later on in the show before we get to Sarah Beek, so stay tuned. Also, if you're in the San Fernando Valley, please come to the Emerson UU Church in Canoga Park on Father's Day. I've been invited to guest minister, and my topic will be the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. It would be great to see you, and maybe we can chat after the service. So come up and tell me you're a fan of the show, and be nice to meet you. Finally, an anthology I contributed to is out. It's called Jesus Through Pagan Eyes by Mark Townsend. I contributed a chapter called A Goddess Advocate Talks About Jesus. I thought it might be of interest to those of you transitioning away from the more traditional religions and embracing goddess. And remember, you can catch any show from the archives if you can't listen live. You also can listen via iTunes. And if you want to chat with me or my guests, the call-in number is 718-766-4662. And when I get to a natural stopping point in the conversation, I'll take your call. So without further delay, let me get to tonight's first guest, Paul Smith. Let me tell you a little bit about Paul before we begin our chat, otherwise we might forget. As I said, he's the co-pastor at Broadway Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Convinced that there's always more, he's been exploring the frontiers of the Christian faith while working on various church staff since he was 18 years old. During his nearly half century of leadership at Broadway Church, the church has evolved from a traditional Southern Baptist church to the integral evolutionary model described in his widely acclaimed new book, Integral Christianity, The Spirit's Call to Evolve, and that's put out by Paragon House. Paul is also author of It's Okay to Call God Mother. Is it okay, he poses the question, is it okay to call God Mother, considering the feminine face of God, and numerous booklets, articles, and CDs. He's taught on the evolving Christian path at seminaries and churches around the country. His passion is to see today's churches become radically inclusive, mystically transcendent, theologically progressive, healing communities focused on the transformation that comes from following Jesus. Amen. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen. It's good to hear your voice.
Well, you know, I did have a chance to chat too long with you and tell you I'm a recovering Catholic from the Bible Belt in New Orleans. So your idea of the future of the church just sounds awesome to me.
All right. Yes, indeed.
So, well, let's start at the beginning. Since is it okay to call God Mother, was that your first sort of foray into, you know, putting the message out there that there was a feminine face of God and maybe we ought to be looking at her again?
Well, yes, it was. Well, it was preceded by when I came to the church 49 years ago, I raised in a traditional Southern Baptist background, and so the church had, you know, men pastors, men deacons, and all the language was male. And so I gradually changed my mind about that, and we began having women leaders and deacons and pastors, and that caused some stir, of course. And then as we began doing that, I became aware then of if we've got women in leadership, how about women in God's image, the feminine image of God? And so I started broaching that, and that was that caused quite a stir. And so we had long discussions over a couple of years' time. And in the meantime, I decided to write this book primarily to convince my congregation, although that was 20 years ago. It's still selling. I can't believe it. It's still on the bookshelves selling copies.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And I wrote it for a traditional audience. It was the kind of book to give give your conservative Catholic or Baptist people, because it's based on the biblical passages and so on. And my thesis was simple, that calling God Father and never Mother says something in our day that Jesus never intended, namely that God is exclusively male or masculine. And this in turn, of course, makes men more like God than women. And so my solution was to call God both Father and Mother. And in years since, many more things, sister, goddess, many more things. But there, I just stayed with Mother. That was a big enough break. And when I finished the book came out. The church still had not yet accepted this, but it was about a year or two later they decided it was okay, and we consistently now are all of our songs and hymns. If we call God Father, then we call God Mother. And we project images behind all the hymns and songs, and they're feminine images of God, feminine images of Jesus. And I only use feminine pronouns for God. I do not use masculine pronouns. Figured we've had enough of them. And so if I refer to God with a pronoun, I call her, she, or hers, or something like that. And we're really comfortable with that, and people value that. They would not give that up for anything in the world now.
Good. Well, I have some questions. That explanation sort of triggered a few things for me. I'm curious, was the influence for you, was it any of the feminist writers or, the stuff that you would normally find in a women's studies class or, I guess I'm just wondering, or was it just intuitively that you came to the idea, or maybe it's the idea that Sophia, Holy Wisdom, has always been feminine until the pronouns got changed? I mean, what was it that started?
It wasn't intuitive at all. Actually, I had a terrible relationship with my mom. It is not natural for me to call God Mother. It was entirely theological. I lead with my head. And I was reading Lisa Scazzoni and some of the other writers back then who were evangelicals, who were calling for the feminine face of God to be shown. And so it was entirely a theological journey. And as I changed my theology and changed my biblical interpretation, I did it against my normal inclination. I'm also gay, so I'm related more easily to men than women. So I really had to go against my own natural thing itself, and so it was theological. It was in terms of what made sense in looking at the Bible and looking at feminist theology today. So it changed my mind, and I then determined, like I always do, to pass that on to my congregation, and wrote a book about it to help do that.
But there wasn't any one thing in particular that started you looking at the feminine face of God as feminine?
Well, yeah. As we had women in leadership, it became apparent as I moved out of my all male club of leaders. You know, that's what Baptists do. It's all men, and was relating to women. I began thinking, well, you know, why do I talk about God as if God were, you know, only male and not goddess and not mother? And so that led me on to the theological. I read hundreds of books every year. And so that was a part of my reading. And I decided I'd just simply been wrong. I'd been exclusive. And I changed my mind.
Well, good, good. That's okay.
Yeah. That's right.
So now you all, it seemed like you said, let's backtrack just a little bit. You said that, because I realize every place is different and every church is different, but my experience, growing up in New Orleans was, evangelicals and Baptists, they were pretty set in their ways, and I guess it surprised me to hear you say that they accepted your book and they accepted this premise, and that they were looking for a feminine face of God too. I mean, because you always hear about the evangelicals like Sarah Palin's church, they're at war
right.
with the Queen of Heaven.
Right.
So
right.
is it are there different factions of Baptists and evangelicals who are more progressive?
Well, there are moderates. When I came to the church, it was a more moderate church. But in my first 10 to 15 years, I regularly moved the church along to make changes. And I'm also very persuasive, so I would just teach and persuade, and we would have discussion groups. And little by little, they would come around. And with Baptists, they always vote on things. And so I didn't start calling God Mother until we voted on it, and I waited 2 years, and we had some people leave, the church in the discussion, but that was a major the whole thing of sexuality, of course, is a major deal. So that was a major change, and now of course it's just natural and normal
right.
the last 20 years at the church, and so we eventually of course we were. The Baptists tried to kick us out, get rid of us for calling God Mother. They tried to get rid of us because I don't believe in eternal hell. They tried to get rid of us because I don't believe that Jesus is the only Savior of the world, that He died for our sins. He's my model of what it means to be one with God. And then, of course, when we started doing gay unions, that was the final straw. So they got rid of us. I bless the Baptists. They were my nurturing place, and it's wonderful. They exist to help people along with where they are. But there came a time when I needed to move along, and our church needed to move along, and so we gracefully exited, and we've been doing fine.
So now, what denomination is your church considered now?
We're just Broadway Church. We're actually affiliated with the Alliance of Baptists, which is a inclusive, feminine welcoming, gay welcoming group. But we don't really have denominations. This is a post-denominational age. Denominational names do more harm than good. Everybody's been hurt by somebody's church.
And you don't really know what you're getting either, necessarily,
That's right.
So I'm going to throw you a couple questions out of left field, only because you seem to be such a liberal thinker, and you can laugh at me. It's okay.
Go with it.
But I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on two things. I talk to a lot of different people on the show who have a lot of different ideas. And, for instance, you have, Margaret Starbird out there, with the idea of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, Mary, that whole thing. Or even that maybe John was gay or Jesus, since he didn't marry, was gay. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on any of that.
Well, I've explored all that, and I think we simply don't know if Jesus was married or not. There's no question. I think Cynthia Barjo's book is very good about Mary, and that Mary was a leader in the church, Mary Magdalene. But we don't know whether he was married or not, and it's okay either way. I think personally, one of my spiritual guides is John. And I think he was gay. I mean, they didn't have that category back then. There was no word
right.
in Greek or Hebrew for
homosexual. Absolutely, yeah. People don't realize that it was just normal.
Yeah. Right. So today he would have found his identity as a gay man, and of course Jesus was very comfortable with Mary Magdalene and connecting with her, and he certainly was comfortable with John leaning on his chest and kissing him and. All those sorts of things. So I just think we can't know for sure about Jesus being married, although I think the indication is that John was gay.
So do you have a thought on if Jesus wasn't married, how did he get out of being married, considered most rabbis, you know, it was, you know, their obligation to marry and have children?
Well, and that's a strong argument for that he possibly was married. But at the same time, he wasn't an official rabbi. So he was the upstart that was an informal rabbi. So, it would have been normal for him to grow up and be married. Most everybody was in that society. And so that's one thing we can assume, that he might possibly have been. It's just that there isn't any evidence that he was. The later Gospels that indicate perhaps that he was at least had a relationship with Mary Magdalene are pretty late Gospels. And what they reflect is that the strong strain in the early church of the feminine face of God. And, like our beloved Roman Catholic brothers and sisters, if the hierarchy won't let him have a feminine God, by golly, they're going to have Mary be God then, because they're going to naturally know instinctively that there's got to be a maternal face of God. So
right.
I think there was a strong strain in the early church that got kicked out with Constantine and the Nicene Creed and all that, where orthodoxy was defined in patriarchal terms and male terms, and we lost the Gospel of Thomas and the feminine face of God and all those other things.
So who do you think, did it start with Paul? Do you think Paul was the biggest enemy of women, and started things down the wrong path for women and, as them not being leaders, or did it happen much later?
I think actually Paul gets a bad rap. I think if we take his seven letters that he wrote, that he really wrote, and not the other ones, the other ones are more conservative. The seven that he really wrote are rather liberal. He doesn't tell slaves to obey your masters in the seven that he really wrote. And so I think he was more in touch with women leaders than we realize. But there were factions in the church. Naturally, the Jewish faction, was pretty patriarchal. And so there were many strains. There were a couple dozen strains of the early church. It was not early Christianity. It was early Christianities. And some of them were patriarchal, and some of them had a place for the feminine face of God. The more mystical strains, of course, did. So, and Paul tended to be, he didn't push that, but I don't think he was anti-feminine in his authentic letters.
Well, so those, you hear that he seemed to be so, that he objected so much to Mary Magdalene, that Jesus spoke to her more than them, or he kissed her somewhere. It seemed very jealous, and that sort of sets the tone for thinking about Paul, I guess. But you think that's maybe it was just sort of a bad rap?
Well, Jesus kissing Mary somewhere, as you said, that's a contrast with Peter.
Peter
and
I'm getting
the
two P's mixed up.
Peter and the other disciples didn't know what to do with that. Although that's a later book, and probably I don't know if that was historical. What it does say is there were once again was this strong feminist perspective and maternal bracing in the early church that produced that book, and so it was there, and we are just about to recapture it.
Yeah. Well, so I forgive me for going off on all these subjects, but it's not often I get somebody like you to talk to and to pick their brain. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on if the Catholic Church would allow women and ordain women in the church, and I'm assuming you'll probably think that's okay, so forgive me for that assumption, that they would be having so much trouble with the pedophilia. I mean, it seems
absolutely. I think it'll be a long, long time before the church allows women priests, because the hierarchy is in place not to make changes, it's to keep things from changing. And I mean, Jesus came to change things and calls us to change things. It's evolution. It's the evolutionary path. But the institutional church, and particularly the Catholic Church, the institution, You only make it to be a cardinal or a pope if you are not a change agent. And so I don't think there's much hope in the next 50 years for women in the Catholic Church, and therefore there'll be more and more women who will leave because they can't take that.
So do you think maybe some women are making a mistake staying within the church and trying to change it from within? It seems like such a thankless job.
It is thankless, and I'm glad they do that. I tried to stay in the Southern Baptist for as long as they let me to change them, but they wouldn't change, and I kept changing, so it didn't work. So I bless anybody wherever they are and whatever they're called to. Praise the Lord for them.
Okay, that's fair. And, you know, in those women priests, I wish they would stop calling themselves women priests. I wish they would just call themselves priestesses.
Oh, right. Yeah, why not?
I interviewed one on my show one night, and I just threw her for a loop with that, you know? And I guess, you know, her. And I asked her, I said, you know, why, you know, if you're doing all of this, why are you taking on the title of a male? Why don't you just take priestess? And she said, well, you know, this is such a new idea. You know, we didn't want to, you know, confuse people about what our role was. And that made sense, you know, that made sense to me.
It's a halfway step, right?
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
You know, it's like actor, actress. Pretty much women are called actors now.
Yeah.
So maybe there'll come a time when priests will include priestess. But right now, I would use both priestess and priest, just like God and goddess. God's a masculine word. And so we do need to use goddess, and we do need to use feminine words until the word God can become more inclusive.
Absolutely. Well, now getting back to your book, Paul, and forgive me for those tangents and other directions.
Oh,
but,
wonderful.
and I want to talk about your newest book, but I just want to wrap up a couple things with the first one. Now, you said, and the title again is It Okay to Call God Mother? You said it's been out there for a while now, and it's still selling really well, which is a wonderful thing. Aside from what we've already said, is there anything else you wanted to share with listeners that's in the book that helped you make the case? You know, for there being a feminine face of God.
Well, I don't know if your listeners would get much out of my book. My book is aimed at people in a traditional church, in a traditional stage in their Christianity, because it quotes lots of scripture verses and makes biblical arguments. And, you know, I don't know that it would be very interesting for your group. Your group would be much more interested in my latest book. Because you have to go through lots of Bible verses before you can get to some ones that are feminine and affirming because of the culture of the day. So, you know, it makes a case for somebody from the traditional place to see that there's an opening to call God Mother. Recommend it.
Well, that's fair. You're awfully honest. I'm just curious. When you say it quotes a lot of Bible verses and stuff, is it Old Testament and New Testament, or?
Sure.
Okay.
So God is like a mother bear. Jesus said, like a mother hen. You know, wisdom. We know in Ruach, spirit, and Sophia, wisdom, are feminine words. So you know, it picks up those threads. But
okay.
It's clear the scriptures, as they are written in the climate of their culture, are written in a patriarchal language and patriarchal metaphors. And it's amazing that the feminine shows through as much as it does. We need to evolve from that and realize we live in a different day and a different age.
And I'm wondering if you talk about Asherah or Lilith or, you know, the Queen of Heaven, you know, that whole story about, you know, you better stop baking those cakes for the Queen of Heaven or it's going to be, we'll be damned.
No, I let the Catholics off pretty easy.
All right. Well. So your new book, Integral Christianity, and that's the Spirit's Call to Evolve. Let's chat about that a little bit. You know, where do you go? You know, how do you depart from the first book into the second book?
Well, let's look at the image of God. The Integral Christianity picks up on five points of integral philosophy, which are articulated by Ken Wilber. and it talks about stages of evolution. I talk about stages of the church, churches of different stages, states of consciousness, altered states of consciousness, the experience of relating to goddess or God. And then I talk about standpoints, which are the way, the perspectives we view God. And I think God has three faces or three dimensions. And the Trinity, the traditional Trinity is, I mean, it's two men and a bird, so the men went out, you know, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so the Trinity has been wonderful. It was a tremendous breakthrough in the 4th century to helping people understand God. But now we need to expand it because the Trinity is all about relating to God as a Father, relating to God as Jesus, and relating to the Spirit, which are all personal, relational relationships. And that's valid as far as it goes. But what if God reveals herself to you as mother or sister or grandmother or beloved? And so I posit that that everything can be looked at in three perspectives. Now, the one perspective is the objective perspective or the it perspective. Looking at God in that perspective, I see that face of God as the infinite face of God, the panentheistic face, that God is in everything and beyond everything. And that's what Paul talked about, God in whom we live and move and have our being. And that's the best way to think about God, to talk about God. And then the second face of God is what I call the intimate face of God, which is where that infinite God that is this impersonal force or in everything and pervades everything comes to us and sits next to us. It kisses us and holds us. And that's the intimate face of God. And the Trinity is a part of that, but it's a very narrow part. So the intimate face of God is however God comes to you in a personal way. And we have to have room for Krishna and Buddha and feminine faces of God that come to us in other religious traditions or in Christianity. And so anyway, God will reveal herself and himself in personal ways depending on your tradition and your background. And so I call that the intimate face of God. And for Christians, it's often Jesus. It is for me Jesus. That's who I have a love for. Beloved personal relationship with, but I wouldn't want to insist on that for Christians or certainly for anybody else. And then the third face of God is what I call the inner face of God. That's where not just that we talk about God as Jesus did, or we talk to God as Jesus did, but we talk as God as Jesus did. As I think Jesus came to model that we are divine, that we have our deepest self, our true self, is God, is divine. And so this is where we identify with God, deep inside of us, God who transcends gender, and that our deepest identification of our true self is a divine self. And, of course, that doesn't go over good with Baptists. But
why not? Why not? I mean,
traditional Christianity would see that God is very separate from humanity.
Okay.
Not quite as separate as Islam says, because at least Christianity says God came down one time and became God, a God person in Jesus. And what I think is Jesus came to say we're all like him. We are all the light of the world, as he said. We are all God people. We just forgotten about it, and we buried it deep under our ego. And so until we lose that ego self, we can't get to the God self. And so that's a kind of a big step for conservatives. But I make the case about owning our divinity and this divine face of God, which also then is a case for, I mean, if you're a woman, then God's face looks like a woman's face in you,
well,
as I honor you.
Well, also, Paul, too, and tell me if I'm wrong, because, I'm obviously, not an expert on this, but I would think if you believe that way, if you believe that we are all divine, we are,
yeah.
Connected to that web, then you damn well better not go bomb somebody else because they are divine. You better talk nice to that person standing, behind the counter because they are divine. I mean, doesn't that automatically set us up to treat each other, with love and respect rather than, oh, they're the other. They have a different God, so we can go kill them.
Well, sure. The hand motions that we at our church do with infinite God in whom we live and move or have our being, it's our hands are up in the air. For inner God, their hands over our heart. For intimate God, their namaste. Their hands in front of us in prayer and namaste. And namaste says, the divine in me honors the divine in you. And if we actually really understand that and sense it and feel it, that we are all one, we are all one. Every sentient being is divine, inspired, and we are all one with each other. It radically alters how we see one another, how we treat one another, how we treat people who are different than us, how we treat men and women and gays and straights and Muslims and everybody. It does. You're exactly right. That it would change the world if we would see the world like Jesus saw it, which is he saw everyone as well, he said it. He said it, you are the light of the world. He meant everybody. And so he could only say that if he thought we were all the light of the world. We are all little baby divinities walking around waiting to grow up. And if we'd all see each other that way, it'd be wonderful. And someday, we'll know that that's true. They call it heaven.
So, Paul, how do Christians, and I'm not going to name any particular group, how can Christians really justify being so unlike Jesus? When they go to Jesus camp and it's Jesus this and Jesus that, and then, you see what the Republicans are doing. I mean, even the conservative bishops are telling them the Ryan plan is immoral. I mean, it's not a rhetorical question. I really wonder, is there something that enables them to disregard acting like Jesus?
Sure. It has to do with the stages of growth that we're in. You can trace the growth of humanity through about five stages from 50,000 years ago. There was the tribal stage, and then the warrior stage about 10,000 years ago. And we have warrior churches today, Fred Phelps and his God Hates Gays Church. Those are the fighting fundamentalists. And then we have the traditional stage that began for humankind about 5,000 years ago. And most churches are still in the traditional stage. And that traditional stage, you can only see what that stage allows you to see. And so that's where you have people that take the Bible in such a literal way, or they exclude people, or they don't see that they're trying to follow Jesus, but they're not acting like him at all. Then you move into the modern stage, which started about 500 years ago, and then we began to have a more modern approach with reason and so on, and then the postmodern stage, and the final stage is just beginning to occur now. It's the integral stage. And a person in each of those stages can't see what a person at a different stage sees. So, if somebody's at a traditional stage, they just think, that there's women are perhaps insignificant, that gays are, condemned by God, and that we need to, kill all the Muslims. That's, they're not being dishonest. That's just all that their worldview can allow them to see. And so an integral view would say, well, I want to understand you. I want to understand that you're sincere. You're trying to be a good person. And I also know that I think in a different way than you, and I think in a more inclusive and more evolved way. And all I can do is just let my light shine, and eventually society will evolve more. The church is slowly evolving. I mean, at least we're not for slavery anymore. And let people, they have to work through their stages where they are. But they're not being mean or bad or terrible. You really can only see what your worldview allows you to see. And you're in a different worldview than a traditional Christian. So you see a much bigger world, and they just don't see that. It's really not visible to them.
And in a way that's hard to comprehend, you know, especially, I mean, I guess, okay, look, I lived in a Catholic bubble for 30 years. It was until I moved out to California, I didn't meet anyone who wasn't Catholic or Baptist. I know what that was like. But then as soon as you're exposed, I think, to new ideas, I don't know, for me it was just an easy shift and transformation. I guess I ask myself, are these people that insulated? That
well, you were for all those years. You sincerely were a conservative Catholic, and you'd think, you know, you lived in the world. Why didn't you have these other ideas, and why weren't you exposed to them? Well, you just didn't see them. They were all around you, but you didn't see them.
Yeah, I guess. You know? I guess I answered my own question.
Yeah, you did. So you know, you need to, have compassion for where you were back then, and look upon that as that's the stage that launched you into the stage you are now, which is much, you know, much bigger and inclusive and closer to our understanding of God personally and understanding. But you know, that's where you used to be is where a lot of people still are.
But there's hope that if I changed, other people can change.
Well, and they are. They are changing.
Yeah.
The changes in society, it used to be 50,000 years ago and then 10,000 years ago. Now it's every few hundred years, culture changes. The postmodern era began in the 1960s in our country with 3%. And now, today, 25% of our population is a postmodern. That's a big change.
Yeah.
And so the change is occurring more rapidly. I mean, I never thought that the country would be the majority of people would be affirming of gays in our country. But that's happened.
So it's this worldview also that we can blame for even illogical stuff, like this anti-contraception thing is stuff that's still coming up.
Well, see, when you say illogical, that's the traditional stage. That's pre-modern. The modern stage, as the woman said going out to the church door to the pastor, "Pastor, you really made me think today. Don't ever do that again." Well, that's the clash between the traditional stage and the modern stage. The modern stage says, well, it's illogical to do what, and the traditional stage is not, they didn't arrive at their position by logic, so you can't use logic to dislodge them. They arrived at it by their worldview.
Okay.
And I spend the first fourth of my book delineating these stages, and the every Christian's at one of these stages. And so if we would understand people grow developmentally by stages, then we would have a greater understanding of where other people are and where we have been, where we've come from, and it takes people, you can't skip a stage, you just have to work your way through it. And you worked your way out of that traditional stage you were in, and you've moved along through several stages in these past years. But you can look back and see you were not a bad person before. You just had a very limiting worldview.
So in your book, do you offer suggestions to how we can maybe bring these guys along a little quicker?
You're an evangelist, aren't you? You make a good evangelical. Well, sure. One is to be where you are, just what you're doing. Now, we also have to, like, when I go to a traditional audience to speak, it depends on what I'm speaking about. You know, I don't unload on them the whole thing. We have to learn a skillful means of communicating. And so if I'm going to talk about homosexuality, I may not talk about the feminine face of God or vice versa. So it's just little pieces that come along. And we witness, what the group you are have an influence in are the postmoderns. That's the group you're influencing. You don't have much of an influence with traditional people because they think I'm crazy. Well, because they have to go through the modern stage first, which just means they simply become logical and reasonable. And the difference between a terrorist and a fundamentalist is you can reason with a terrorist. And they simply aren't being mean. They just haven't moved into letting their religious tradition or their spirituality become reasonable. And so postmodern people have said, yes, we understand reason, and that reason separates out all the magical and all the crazy stuff. And now we move even past the modern. And so that's your audience. And you're not going to, people at the traditional level aren't going to listen too much to you. They barely listen to me.
I know. I actually have relatives who still live in Louisiana who are just appalled because they're so afraid I'm going to burn in hell. And I said, don't worry about it. I'm not worried.
That's right. And, you know, bless their heart, they really do believe that. And there's not much we can do about them.
Right.
Your audience are the postmoderns.
And thank goodness.
Yeah.
And so once we get to postmodern, then the next step is integral, you said?
That's right.
Okay,
that's right.
Is that the last step? We're almost there?
I believe evolution is forever.
Okay.
That when Jesus said, I have more to tell you, much more to tell you, but you can't take it now, what he was recognizing was that people are in various stages. And he had dumped enough on the people in that stage that was all they could take. And to dump any more would not do any good. So he said, the Spirit's going to reveal more as the years go on. And so I believe evolution is forever. I believe God is evolving. We're all evolving. Evolution is infinite. We will grow and evolve forever and ever. And as we know our oneness with God, we realize that God herself is also evolving. So there's no end stage, but I believe the stage at this point in our history that is just emerging is the integral stage, which puts together more of the more visions and views and understandings of cultures than any other stage before. And so it transcends but includes the postmodern stage. And my book, Integral Christianity, is the first book to apply integral theory to Christianity. But integral theory can be applied to Buddhism, to Islam, to the spiritual but not religious, to anyone. And I believe it's the next step after postmodern.
So, all right. So I guess I'm wondering. You know, you say you really just dangled a carrot there. You said something to the effect of Jesus said we can't take any more right now. You know what I started thinking about? That book that was out, I don't know, maybe in the 80s, The Celestine Prophecy, where the folks who evolved just sort of became an energy force. And that's what I'm thinking, you know, that's what I'm thinking we couldn't take that will eventually, I don't know, do you remember in Star Trek, those episodes where we just did away with our body and we just become a brain?
Isn't that what we are? Basically, we're energy fields. We're light beings, and so as we come to understand that, I mean, when our body dies, we what's left is our energy field, our light being. That was what the resurrection was. It wasn't about Jesus's body. It was about his spirit, his subtle body, his energy body, being visible, and that we could see it. And he said, "We're all going to come to that." And so we're all evolving, and maybe someday we'll. There won't be the physical realm. There'll only be the energetic realm. That'd be okay.
So do you believe in reincarnation, that we keep coming back?
Well, that's sure one possibility. There was a strong stream in the early church of those who believed in reincarnation, and it was outlawed. Origen probably was a reincarnationalist. So that might be one way that we grow, but there are probably a multitude of ways. I mean, some people may choose to come back. Others may move to parallel universes or off into ways that we don't understand yet. So that's certainly one possibility.
Interesting. So now you say something in your new book, Integral Christianity. God is in 3D. What do you mean by that? Are you talking about the Trinity?
Well, that's the one I just described to you. The Trinity is a threefold explanation of God that was appropriate in the fourth century, Father, Son, and Spirit. But today, I think we need to expand that to what I call God in 3D or God in three dimensions. The one dimension is the the God we talk about, which is the infinite face of God. The second dimension is the intimate face of God, the God whom we relate to personally and up close, that walks with us, that's always with us, that holds us and comforts us. And the third dimension of God is the inner dimension, where we identify with God as our true self, and that's the inner dimension. Those are the three dimensions of God,
the infinite face,
the intimate face, and the inner face. They are all incredibly important, and most spiritual paths leave out one or two of them. And Integral says, let's put them all together. We desperately need to have all three dimensions of God, whether we're Christians or whatever we are. And I believe it is the most incredible breakthrough in anybody's understanding of God in the last 2,000 years, to understand God that way, no matter what religion you belong to.
Now, I assume you're teaching this to the folks in your church. Are they liking this?
Oh, they love it. They love it. For 10 years, so when we gather together, we will often raise our hands up and say, infinite God in whom we live and move and have our being, and then we put our hands together in namaste to each other and say, intimate God, you are always with us, and we put our hands over our heart and we say, inner God, I am the light of the world. And that's our replacement for Father, Son, and Spirit. We don't use Father, Son, and Spirit anymore. We use infinite face, intimate face, and inner face.
And I would assume that's how you see the future. That's where we all ought to be headed.
I believe so. It's the most inclusive way to view God. Actually, it's the way to view everything. This conversation we're having right now, you can view it on those three perspectives. There's the objective perspective, the telephone conversation, the times, the mechanism for getting this, all the physical things about it. Then there's the intimate dimension. What's going on between you and me? What's going on? That's a part of describing and understanding this conversation that we're having. And then there's a third dimension, which is what's going on in you, the subjective dimension. And so that's everything can be looked at from those three dimensions, the I dimension, the we dimension, and the it dimension. I'm just applying it to God.
I see.
It's universal. And I go into this in some detail in the book, because it's a basic framework of integral philosophy. And it opens up ways of understanding lots of things, especially God.
So did you come up with this idea, Paul, or are you just sort of, talking about a theory that's sort of, sprouting up out there, in all different areas?
Integral theory has been primarily articulated by a man who's called the Einstein of consciousness, Ken Wilber, who happens to be a practicing Buddhist. But he has examined the philosophies and traditions and psychologies and everything of hundreds and hundreds of cultures and traditions and so on, and he has seen these three perspectives, these three dimensions, and allowed and put them together in an integral way. He's written about 25 books, and the integral philosophy is a major current of philosophy now. I just happen to be the first person that has applied integral philosophy to Christianity. And so my book is the first one that's taken this very, very inclusive, incredible, wonderful way of looking at everything and applied it to the Christian faith.
Well, you know what, Paul? I think you need to be the new pope.
Oh, you could really be cruel, can't you?
But that would be a bad thing.
Well, no, I know what you mean. I do hope I have some influence because I want to invite people to a more expansive place in life, regardless of their spiritual path. I mean, my path happens to be Jesus, but if your path is Goddess, or your path is Buddha or Krishna or whatever, let's join together in this more inclusive way and just enjoy our life and our relationship with the divine.
Well, I said that, sort of, tongue in cheek, but, I guess it does make me wonder, is there sort of a parallel, I don't know if that's the right word. Does the Pope have a progressive counterpart? I mean, is there anybody out there in the world that's Christian, that's high profile, that thinks like you do? You know, that thinks like, you know, like we do. That's postmodern.
Well, yes, there's some priests that do. Richard Rohr is a Franciscan priest who is an integral Catholic, and he's got a wide following. Father Keating is a I forget what kind of priest he is, but he's the one that says it's our duty to become God. So he buys into what I'm talking about. But these are not people in the hierarchy, because you don't get into the hierarchy by being different.
Right.
So, you know, the institutional just have to go along as it has, and we just have to do our thing in the world and let our light shine.
Well, now I want to ask you a little bit about the nuns. I love the nuns. I have always loved the nuns, and I think the nuns are getting a real bad rap.
And I
wonder, why don't they? I mean, is it financial? I mean, why don't they just break away and say, "Oh, forget about it. We're doing our thing. We're taking care of the poor. You know, we don't care about your dogma like you do." You know, can't they just go independent?
Well, some of them have, and many of them have. Some of them see the bigger picture, but they love the church and they hope it will change. Others are in a traditional stage, and they're just loving and doing their work, and they don't feel any need to break from the Catholic Church. So there's all three of those places, and you know, I'm glad there's a place for everybody. I came across a fellow who was just in a gang and became a Christian, and he's in with some kind of fundamentalist group. But I was thankful for that fundamentalist group because they were the only one that could talk his language. I mean, he could come to my church, and we wouldn't affect him at all because he was back at the warrior stage. And so he needed a traditional church to bring him along spiritually. Now, hopefully he'll grow in that and pass through that stage and move on up. So you know, the traditional Catholic Church provides a place for those that are at a traditional level, and when they evolve past that, then we've got to have other places, and every religion needs to have higher stages of it so that people can continue to evolve. If people knew about Jesus the way I knew about him, they wouldn't need to stop being Christians. They could keep following Jesus but become progressive and liberal and embrace the feminine of God and all these things. But they just don't know about that. They're not there yet. And there's a place for all these stages.
Well, Paul, you have been awesome. I have really enjoyed talking to you tonight, and you taught me some stuff. I didn't know about these different stages, and it really helps me understand when I turn on the news and I see the right-wing people going crazy.
Right.
It helps me understand, because, you know, really, I've been stuck. You know, I've been thinking, you know, are they just this cruel? Are they just this selfish? But I don't know, I think I'm thinking different about it now after having spoken to you.
Well, you're wonderful, Karen. You're a great interviewer and a great seeker, and what a gal you are.
Well, listen, let's make sure our listeners know your website, and let's mention your books again. So your website is easy. It's revpaulsmith.com, revpaulsmith.com. And the books, Is It Okay to Call God Mother? But you think my listeners would probably rather Integral Christianity.
Oh, yes. Is it Okay to Call God Mother was 20 years ago, and I was at a different place. It's written for a conservative audience. But your listeners would love Integral Christianity because it will give them a new picture of Jesus and of God that they can appreciate, and they would love it. And it's Paragon House's bestseller right now.
Okay. Well, but I'm wondering, okay, just going back to Is It Okay to Call God Mother, would that help somebody know how to talk to a conservative about this?
Yes. Yes.
It would. So I mean,
absolutely,
it would serve a purpose. You know, you'd help you speak the language of somebody you might not otherwise be able to communicate with.
Well, it's the book you give your priest or your Baptist pastor, and that's what I wrote it for. That's right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, cool. Yeah. All right, Paul. I'm so glad Jan recommended you. It's been swell. Thank you so much. And I hope you'll keep in touch. And when you have something interesting to talk about again, you'll come back on the show.
Thank you, Karen. Bless you.
Night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking, the feminine consciousness, the great she. We talk about all of that in terms of deity, archetype, and ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks, well, you know what? They have the substance to change the world, and we are changing the world little by little. And you've been listening to Paul Smith, a progressive Christian who's standing up and saying, hey, hey, wait a minute, we've been getting it all wrong. Let's look at the new paradigm, sacred masculine alongside divine feminine. And his two books, Is It Okay to Call God Mother? And Integral Christianity, The Spirit's Call to Evolve. Awesome. I hope you enjoyed his interview as much as I did. And you hear that sound, and if you're a regular to the show, you know what that means. You know we're crossing the threshold into the second half of the show. And next up, we have a woman I can't wait to get to know a little bit better. I think she's a woman after my own heart. They say the young women aren't getting it, that they aren't carrying the torch forward. Well, I have a feeling that Sarah Beek would prove them wrong. Let me tell you a little bit about Sarah, and then we're going to start our chat, because she's got some juicy books out there. But Sarah, she's a Harvard-trained scholar of comparative world religions who spent years traveling the world studying spirituality, from whirling with the Sufi dervishes to meeting the Dalai Lama on her 21st birthday, from taking the host from a Croatian Catholic mystic who had the stigmata to having life-altering visions with shamans and everything in between. The New York Times called her one of the new role models for her generation. She's the author of The Red Book, A Deliciously Unorthodox Approach to Igniting Your Divine Spark, and the forthcoming book, Red Hot and Holy, A Heretic's Love Story. I just love her titles. Besides these creative projects, she is the co-host of Shootin' the Spiritual Shit radio show on an Ethos Radio, and she offers Red Treats, Redvolution Workshops, Talks, and mentorships, and I am going to say hello to Sarah right now. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, Karen. So good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show tonight. I was just so intrigued by your work. I love your website and all the stuff that you're up to. Wow, what an interesting life you've already lived. So tell me a little bit about some of the stuff in your bio, whirling with Sufi dervishes and meeting the Dalai Lama.
Yeah. When I was in college and after college and grad school and after grad school, I went through just an intense time of traveling around the world as often as I could, whenever I could afford it, to really try to observe and interview and practice some of the religious traditions that I had been so passionately studying in the classroom. So I just got incredibly lucky. I was able to meet some just remarkable human beings, and I was able to have some really great experiences, which just helped, you know, as you know, anchor all this information into more of a lived reality.
Well, you know, I don't know whether you, I mean, why would you have looked at my website, but you'd see that I wrote Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and my husband and I, like, traveled across five continents chasing down sacred sites of Goddess. And in the process, you know, met whirling dervishes, danced with whirling dervishes, that whole sort of thing, and, you know, just saw so much when you get out to these other worlds and these other cultures. And, you know, I almost feel like it ought to be a requirement for everyone, because it broadens your horizon, you know? I mean, I think only 15% of Americans have passports, and that's insane. I mean, Americans need to get, you know, off this continent and go see the rest of the world, then maybe we wouldn't bomb so many places.
I so agree with you. I really agree with you. And I did see that book on your site. Your site is wonderful, by the way, and that book looks fabulous. And both your books that I saw on your site just look really incredible. And you know, I definitely worked to make it happen. I would, you know, work 3 jobs in a row for 6 months and then take off and, you know, go travel. So it's definitely doable. And you're right. It changes everything. It really shifts your perspective. And I just think for Americans, it makes you a lot more humble, you know.
Well, it does. It does. I mean, and you see other people differently. I mean, they suddenly are not other anymore. You know, they're a mother and a father and you know, they're people. You know, they become people, not just, you know, a bag of flesh somewhere whose life is valueless. And you start to learn, you know, their culture and their food. You know, I think food is a wonderful way to start appreciating another culture, too.
I so agree. That's my favorite part.
Imagine all the food we would miss.
I know. Whenever I hear somebody coming back from a country, it's like the first thing I ask them. I'm like, how was the food? Because it's Yeah, it's an important part, and who gathers around the food and where the food comes from and what it means symbolically. It's just it's very rich. Yeah.
Well, you probably didn't hear the part of the conversation I had with Paul. I mean, I come from you know, the Bible Belt of New Orleans, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know what that's like to live in these narrow, fearful boxes, you know, and you don't go beyond the maybe 50 miles of where you grew up, and you don't meet people who aren't like you, and really it's such a shame, you know, because there's so much out there. I just wish there was a way for everyone to experience more. I don't know, I think that, you know, that would lead us to this idea of being, you know, the cliche of being able to love our neighbor, you know, because we might have met our neighbor, you know, and I don't know, I guess, I'm sorry I'm going off on a tangent here, but I'm thinking, you know, the anti-gay stuff out there and, you know, the anti-whatever it is, I really think it's sometimes because these folks just have not met somebody who's not like them. And once you meet somebody who's not like you, I mean, you know, you find out you really have a lot more in common than you're different. And again, that's a cliche, but I think it's just so, so true.
Oh, I very much agree with you. I think it's so important. It's so important.
So tell me about the Croatian Catholic mystic who had the stigmata.
Yes, I went on a pilgrimage after graduate school to Bosnia and Croatia, and I was at Medjugorje in Bosnia, and then the group of us spent about a week on a little island called Mali Lošinj, which is a Croatian island, and there was this young guy. I mean, he was probably, I think he was around 31. His name is Father Sudac. And he had the stigmata, and it's one of the only stigmatas recently that was actually verified by the Vatican as the real deal. And he performed miracles. I never saw him levitate, but other people have seen him levitate. He bilocates. I did receive a blessing from him, which was very, very intense, very, very strong energy, which I had no idea. I was not expecting at all. But, you know, it was a very good learning lesson for me because being a student of world religions, you know, there was such a huge part of that journey at first was just being so incredibly open and receptive to every tradition and mystical tradition and every person I would meet and just every practice I would come across. And I was just really like a sponge, you know, just sort of soaking everything up and being really respectful. And actually, the blessing that this mystic saint gave me wasn't very good for me. And like my body actually reacted very poorly for about a year afterwards.
Really?
And, you know, yeah, and really doing a lot of work around it, you know, not just reacting, but really paying attention. And for me, it was one of the lessons among many that I've had since then of the power of discernment, you know, and being really aware of what is in alignment.
So do you mean by discernment that maybe it wasn't a good idea to take the blessing?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was actually part of, you know, a few things had happened before then, but I think I had a little bit more of a naive perspective about the world of spirituality and definitely mysticism. I think I was a little bit more just like, it's all God, it's all good. And it's not that it's not all God on sort of a grand, you know, level of things, but any sort of spiritual path to me, there's a time period where the practice of discernment comes into play, and that was actually sort of like a kickoff for me. Yeah.
Wow. Well, and, you know, I guess I'm naive too and still am, Sarah, because I can't, I would imagine if I probably would have taken the blessing too. Well, you know, I remember the first time, do you know who Amma is, the hugging saint? From Kerala. Well, you know, I met her here in Los Angeles, and I didn't know much about her, but all my, you know, friends said, oh, you have to come see her, you have to come see her, she's awesome, she's the living goddess. And so I said, okay, let's come see her. Well, as it turned out, when she walked into the room, the way the aisle parted, I was on the edge of, you know, on the edge of the aisle, and as she came down the aisle, I was one of the people she touched. And I wasn't expecting anything, because, you know, I didn't know that much about her, quite frankly, so it wasn't like I had any expectations. But it was incredible. When she touched me, it felt like electricity just went through my entire body. And, it's hard for me to language it, but it felt like something happened in that moment. And I don't know, I walked away feeling like, you know, maybe she really is the real deal, you know, on a much more higher spiritual level than, you know, the 99.9% of us. But fortunately, I didn't have any bad side effects.
I have a strong affinity for Amaji and her work. A dear friend and I were asked to actually study her satsang group in Boston when I was in graduate school. So we got to spend a lot of time just around, you know, many of her devotees and people that had just had extraordinary experiences with her. And then when we met her in person, similar to what you were saying, you know, that happened to you, definitely happened for me too. And I was surprised and really amazed and very inspired by her, not only because of, I mean, on the first hand, because, like, her humanitarian work is off the charts. I mean, it's just the work that she's done in the world, from hospitals to schools to homes for people. I mean, what she's created is just pretty astounding. But also what I love about her, and it was really important for me in graduate school to experience this, was that I had been around, you know, and studied many different saints and gurus, and definitely many in India, and had spent a lot of time in India. And very often, you know, the form of darshan that they give people is, you know, usually not through touch. They might do a light touching of the hand on, like, the forehead, but usually that's just not really the deal. And what's so impressive to me with Amaji is that not only was she born in sort of a lower caste, but then she also came from Kerala and was in not a very wealthy family. And she grew up with these sort of cultural conditions that definitely sort of asked her not to touch other people, and certainly not to bring people in for a hug, certainly not to bring anybody in for a hug. And the fact that she does this, you know, that she hugs anyone and everyone, to me is such a sort of prime example of the divine feminine to me. It's sort of like a big fat belly flop into eminence, you know, like that she actually, like, touches people and, like, brings them in for a hug. And it's just, it's very radical when you look at her cultural conditioning, you know, where she came from.
Yeah, she's overcome a lot and really transcended all of that. Well, you know, I'll drop the subject of the mystic with the stigmata after this last question. You know, I'm mulling it over in my mind, and I wonder if the blessing somehow had a negative effect on you, because I don't know, when you think of stigmata, you know, you think suffering, you know. I wonder if that maybe was what he, maybe the energetic that went out, you know. Have you thought about it? I mean, do you
definitely. I've always been someone who's very sensitive to the energetic realms. I mean, I was born that way, and I think the energy that he was channeling through him to bless me just wasn't in alignment with my energetic system. It's almost like, you know, when you eat a food that's just like not in alignment with you, and even if it's in alignment with other people, it doesn't make anything wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, yeah, it wasn't the right thing for me at all.
So it's not necessarily that it was negative. It just somehow didn't jive with your energy field.
Exactly. It's my unique system and my unique reaction. And I'm very clear about that. You know, I don't think he's a bad person at all. I mean, I think what he's doing, you know, I loved him. I loved the work that he was sharing. He kind of reminded me of what I would imagine Jesus would actually be like. Like, he was pretty radical, extremely liberal, just so passionate. And everything that he was really teaching was very much firmly rooted in love. You know, you could tell
mm-hmm.
that. But it was still a very different tradition and definitely a different energy for me.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was part of becoming aware of that, you know, not judging it, but just being like, oh, that's
yeah.
not the right energy for
yeah,
me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think now hearing your story, I'll think twice and maybe have a little bit discernment next time somebody wants to give me a blessing. So you heard my intro, you know, and I mean I'm 55, and you know, women of my age, you know, we're not quite the women who, you know, fought for equal rights and all of that stuff. They're older than us, and they have been lamenting, as now we are lamenting, where are the young women that are going to, you know, carry this work forward. And then I hear that the New York Times called you one of the new role models for your generation. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe you get to carry this big mantle on your shoulders. I'm wondering, what were you doing that the New York Times found you and recognized that in you?
Well, it was an article based on, I think it was four or five of us. Most of the other women I know and are friends of mine, and we're each doing this work in our own way. And so actually it was one of my friends who really, you know, wrote into the New York Times, I think for about 6 months, you know, sort of pitching this story of the next generation of which she called, you know, spiritual leaders. And so they finally bit. And so they called. I mean, I had no idea this was going on until I got a call one morning from the New York Times. And it, you know, it was an interesting article. It's not my favorite article that's ever been written.
It's great for your bio, though.
it's good for the bio, and I'm definitely grateful for it. And I think, just to answer your question, though, that there are many, many women now in my generation who are really, really respectful of all the women who have come before us and that have helped us, like, just become more informed and knowledgeable about everything that you all know. And it's created a pathway for us to follow, and definitely in our own way, as each generation does, you know, to evolve some of it and to, I don't know, just share our own experiences with it. So I see right now, actually, especially when my first book came out in 2006, I kind of felt like one of the only ones who was speaking about this directly publicly in such a way. And now, you know, 6 years later, I just see so many other women in my generation stepping forward. So, you know, we have a tremendous amount of respect and just honor for everyone that's gone before us, and we're going to do our best.
Well, so let me ask you, do you think we've just been paranoid and, you know, maybe not looking in the right place? Or do you think maybe there was maybe, maybe a little part of time there when, you know, when younger women were, well, you know, they didn't realize that some of these rights could slip away, and that, you know, maybe they needed to keep pushing. I remember reading an article about, you know, the younger women, you know, just wanting to be wives, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, the generations before that fought to, you know, be able to be something other than a wife. And I guess I'm just curious, you know, to sort of pick your brain and wonder if, you know, have the older women been seeing it wrong, getting it wrong, or were they right but things are shifting? I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, they're important questions. I honestly don't know if I can speak to all of that well. I definitely do see and very much do agree that some of what you just said regarding younger women not quite realizing that the rights that they have now could be taken away, and that they are recent rights that they were fought very hard for. And I do think that when, you know, you've grown up when these rights have been there, you know, like I grew up with, like, yeah, I can do anything I want as a woman. Like there wasn't, I never really had that experience of thinking, like, no, I actually can't do something because I am a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you are raised like that, that's definitely part of your makeup, and it does mean you actually have to sort of step out of your framework to understand that it's not all great out there. It's not all, you know, it hasn't been easy, and that this is still a threat. So on one hand, I do think our generation does have to be, you know, shaken a bit at times, for sure, because that wasn't part of our upbringing. Yeah.
So do you think this last year or year and a half of, you know, Republicans with these cultural issues and, you know, trying to thwart even contraception, I mean, has it been a shock to your peers?
Yeah. That's definitely woken some people up. Yeah, you know, and I live in San Francisco, so this is a very it's always been a very awake and aggressively liberal city. So, again, I know I'm sort of speaking from a little bit of a bubble in some ways there. When I travel, when I see other people, when I'm around other women, I do notice the trend of sort of an apathy sometimes, or just sort of not really the full awareness of what's going on out there. So, as I said before, I don't think as you're referring that you all are seeing something or not seeing something, I think you're seeing it all. And I just think what you're seeing is a mixture.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different generation. We do have to be shaken up at certain times. And also because we were raised in a way not having to deal with as much as the generations before us, because of that, naturally, we have encountered some of this material and even ideas like, for instance, the divine feminine very differently than the women who have come before us. So the way we've encountered them adds something else to the plate. It doesn't replace anything, but it adds something else because, you know, we're hitting all this material and just on a different angle.
Well, that's interesting, and I want to definitely talk about your book, so let's sort of use that to segue. First let's start with, how do you identify yourself? Or you, what I've sort of coined the term goddess advocate, because, you know, we don't know what to call ourselves. You know, maybe we're not pagans, maybe we're not Wiccans, but we found goddess, and we like this idea of a feminine face of God for all sorts of reasons. Do you consider yourself in that category? And I guess if so, what do you call yourself? Or do you even, does it matter?
No, I mean, I call myself a Redvolutionary.
Okay.
And to me, that's just someone who I'm more interested in the direct experience of the divine. And for me, the divine has shown up very strongly in the feminine. And so because of that, sort of the resulting healings around that and just awakenings around that and, you know, scholarship around that, it's definitely been my passion in the past. So the material that I present to women more often than not, it's from that angle. It's from more of the feminine face of God, because it's just, that's what speaks to me the most. And I see it, you know, speaking to so many women.
So So a two-pronged question for you. Is it red, you know, is it the obvious, blood? And secondly, you said you come to the feminine face of God different than, you know, the younger generation than maybe some of the older women. How is your experience finding her different? And yeah, and is the red about blood, you know, sacred
sure.
blood?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I don't know if I think the finding of her or coming to her is different so much. But I think because I haven't had to hit as many barriers as I think the generations before me have. So it's allowed me a little bit of just a different, more of a freer relationship with her because
mm-hmm.
I didn't have to hit so many things. You
mm-hmm.
know, it wasn't like so radical when I started speaking about God as she, you know, using that pronoun. And that just, so in that, that's the way that I mean that there are some differences.
So
you know,
that trail had
yeah.
already been blazed, so it wasn't like this was a radical idea.
No, it wasn't a radical idea. You know, like everyone had heard of, you know, goddess and different goddesses from around the world and the divine feminine and archetypes. So when I actually, you know, started really encountering her, I think like most women, it wasn't really a choice for me. You know, it wasn't like I'm going to go study the goddess. Like, in my opinion, and this is, again, I don't think this is uncommon, she really came for me. Like, I did not have a choice. In fact, my first encounter, I think, with her was through one of her faces, which is the Hindu goddess Kali. And, I mean, you can bet your ass I didn't want to get to know this idea of the feminine
face. Yeah, she's pretty fierce.
She's pretty intense. I was like, next, anybody else? You know, like, not what I'm wanting to be doing right now. But she just made her presence known and known and known and known in such a way that I couldn't really turn away from it because it would be like turning away from life.
No, I get that.
Yeah. So that, I don't think that's so different. Red for me is actually, it's the color and the energy through which she showed up for me. And, you know, 9 times out of 10 when I would be doing my scholarship or traveling or, you really had any sort of medium in front of me, there would be something about red, either the color or, and I know it sounds strange, but even like the energy of red, and it would point to this more sort of mystico-erotic, unorthodox, transgressive, more heretical face of the feminine divine that more often than not has been shoved to the corners, not only of our religions and, you know, mystical traditions, but also in our psyches. And I even found, you know, and I'll, you know, in my earlier experiences with it, even some of like the goddess groups that I, you know, brushed up against, even there I couldn't quite find this presence of red that was really beckoning to me. And so, you know, I really went on a search for years in some ways to just try to figure out who this red lady was.
Well,
and,
you know, I think I can relate to what you're talking about, and tell me if this resonates with you. I think Kali is very much like the Egyptian lion-headed goddess Sekhmet, and the red, it's activation, it's motivation, it's anger, it's tenacity, it's strength, it's passion, it's fire, it's not fluffy bunny stuff. You know,
no.
it's in, you know, it's what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, you know, it's ferocious. And you know what? And that's a good thing because I think women who, I hope I don't get in trouble saying this, women have to not be afraid of their power. And yeah. I think this red, whether it's Kali, whether it's Sekhmet, whether it's red, whatever you want to call it, women need to find that. And, you know, they need to stop being handmaidens of the patriarchy. They need to, you know, stand up, be counted, and do like the Dalai Lama said, save the friggin' world, you know?
Yeah.
And that's really it. That's the red energy. Women everywhere have to find it. And, you know, and it's not the Mama Grizzlies. I think it's the Sekhmets and the Kalis, you know, that are going to change the world from the status quo into, you know, something for the most of us rather than the few, you know, who benefit from it. So that's me on my soapbox. I'm sorry.
No, I loved it. Please. I mean, I'm just nodding the whole time. I really agree. And, you know, personally, I think for like a skinny white girl, Midwestern, like people pleaser, you know, encountering sort of the red feminine was pretty massive and hard not to see, you know, the sort of revolutionary elements of it within my own life and then definitely within different traditions and other women's lives as well. So it's, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, for me, you know, growing up in the South, you were taught to be nice. You were taught
yes.
to, you know, not speak up. You know, don't talk about, you know, controversial things at the dinner table. You know, you don't want people to be uncomfortable. Well, you know what? Those things need to be talked about because if you don't shine light on them, then nobody even knows it's going on. I have so many girlfriends who don't have a clue that they're even oppressed. You know what I mean? And so they sort of just continue to be complicit in their own oppression, and they don't even get it. I totally get that. You know, it's a big shift when you go from, you know, being, you know, the you know, in a way, you think about Mary, the goddess Mary. She's the feminine face that they could tolerate because she was safe. You know, she wasn't going to be like, you know, Diana or Artemis who, you know, had her wild side that, you know, that they might not be able to control. I'm sure you know what I mean.
Yes, yes. No, definitely. I know. I mean, it's fascinating how red is portrayed. I mean, you can start noticing it even in just like commercials and films. And I mean, it's pretty strong, you know, the fear of it, the misunderstanding of it, the shadow side of red. It has a very interesting presence on this planet and hasn't necessarily been welcomed, you know, with open arms, even though that's kind of clearly where she needs to be.
And I'm wondering, too, with your red tent, I'm wondering if your red tent is the red tent or your red treats. Are you talking about the same sort of, I know there's a red tent movement out there where they teach women and young girls to have a better relationship with their sacred blood and their menses. Are you talking about the same thing or is yours something different?
Yeah, mine's a bit different. I've been in the red tent, what I call the red tent, for over 2 years now, and it's just been a real, again, what I call a red night of the soul, but a real process of just personal transformation. I've had to let go of a lot of things in my life, my career, a lot of relationships I really needed to bury in terms of trying to write this book that I'm finishing right now, which is really my story with red. And it's been a very intense, you know, purification process. I call it like it's sort of a, you know, her womb and her oven. So I just feel like I've been getting cooked for about 2 years.
That makes total sense. It's almost like all women sort of have to go into that that oven and experience that red night of the soul and sort of like rebirth themselves, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's something that just happens naturally. You know, it's not something to be forced. I think when, you know, the time to go in for each of us, it'll happen yeah, just very appropriately. So, you know, one of the big changes that has actually happened with my work during this Red Night of the Soul and during this Red Tent has been less about trying to promote red for every woman and more about how can women get in touch with their own unique essence and expression of the divine feminine. And that might be purple, that might be pink polka dotted, that might not have a color, you know. And, you know, as I found with my unique essence, like my red lady actually did not have a match on this planet. She shined through, you know, other goddesses like Kali or Mary Magdalene or Sekhmet. But who I am in relationship to actually doesn't have a set form or name. And so what I call her is the Red Lady. And she's actually like a higher element of me, which took me up until about a year ago to figure out. But my work has sort of shifted, and it was a big shift for me. Instead of being like, everybody's a revolutionary and everyone should experience the Red Lady and everyone needs to like tap into their redness, to more like, actually, I'm just really curious, like, what's in alignment with your soul right now, and how is your feminine divine, your unique essence and expression of that actually showing up, and how can you form a more intimate relationship with it?
So that's what you mean when you say heaven women find their divine spark.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I'm sort of less about everyone come on my red bandwagon.
Yeah, because everybody, like you said, everybody isn't red. Everybody wasn't meant to be red.
No, no, and the soul journey is pretty precise, you know, like most of us, this isn't our first time around, so, you know, what some women are here to experience this time, and some men, is very specific, and I'm kind of just have a lot more respect and honor for that path and awareness of it than I did years ago, and so I'm just more interested in definitely reminding people of the feminine face of the divine, the various expressions, and learning as much as we can from them, but also making sure we don't let those expressions that come from the past somehow cramp our present soul expression.
So in other words, you mean like if you, just as an example, if you grew up in, say, a fundamentalist household, that you give yourself permission to sort of maybe let go of that to find your authentic self. Is that what you sort of mean,
I mean, I think I find that a lot of my work is around like almost like baggage removal. Where it's anything, you know, that's inside myself or other people that it has gotten in the way of our intimate sort of direct relationship with the divine. I'm more interested in sort of looking at that and letting it go, and in particular with our relationship with the divine feminine, which we, as you know, we have a tremendous amount of baggage around on this planet, and I think I've just been, repeatedly astounded by how much baggage there is, and also, you know, and I, again, I say this with all respect, and I don't mean to in any way downplay any of the work that so many women are doing with goddesses and archetypes and et cetera. But I knew for me there just came a point on my journey where actually all the external information about what the goddess is and all the ancient archetypes, there just came a time where I needed to let it go and let how she was showing up in me really step forward. Mm-hmm. Because often she would step forward in a way that didn't match, you know, the sort of traditional goddess explanations of the past or the present. And it was very confusing for me, and it made me doubt myself. I doubted myself. I mean, nobody made me. I did. So because of that, I really sort of learned, you know, that I'm the process of purification and the Red Ten, it has been letting go, and really asking her to show me what I'm made of. And my, you know, my relationship with who I call the Red Lady, who really is this higher element as me, it's mine. You know, it's a very specific
unique.
Yeah, and just like, and that's, it's such my primary relationship, and it's my priority, and it's changed everything. That, of course, whenever any of us have an experience like that, you naturally want other women to know their unique essences, you know, like, what's your lady called?
Well, and you know, and I'm thinking probably if all of that information, you know, all of that external stuff hadn't been out there, you know, it probably sort of primed your pump, you know, to give yourself permission to be able to take that next step to where you are now, you know.
You are so right.
You know, it's sort of like it was transitioning you to this ultimate place that you're in, which is awesome. So let me just ask you. I'm curious, when you say the your Red Lady, are you talking deity, archetype, ideal? I mean, do you believe in a deity in the heavens, or do you believe that, you know, more, you know, is this a real essence that looks over you? I'm, you know, no right or wrong answer here. It's not a trick question. I'm just,
yeah.
I'm just curious.
Yeah. So, she is sort of my God self, or we would say goddess self. And so I am actually like her human incarnation. There's different levels of her. There's different levels of myself, my goddess self. And, it, you know, as strange as this sounds, it was really very natural how it happened. I actually, you know, I've met each of myself on each of myself on each of the dimensions. And with her, it's we to make up her body as she stretches through the universe. So right now I'm her only current human incarnation of this particular expression. And I think, you know, sort of coming into this awareness and having the repeated experience of it, and for a scholar from Harvard in comparative world religions, you know, when you hit some of this experiences and this material and you're incredibly discerning and inquisitive about it, but you know, I'm skeptical and, you know, all that stuff around it, it sort of makes my degree from Harvard want to barf all over itself, you know. It's like, what are you talking about? But this is sort of the path I've just, you know, I've just had to really be more and more open to, which, again, is allowing her to guide me instead of me trying to fit her into these sort of spiritual and religious paradigms that I studied for years.
Well, you know, it's the battle of the left and the right brain, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, I just got finished writing an article for a journal, and the whole time I'm writing it, I'm thinking, okay, am I writing this as a practitioner or a scholar? You know,
yeah.
does God create us, or do we create God? You know, it's and that whole idea of if you believe in some sort of supreme other source, the divine whatever, then is it anti-intellectual? You know, it's a
right.
conundrum.
It's such a conundrum, and I really appreciate what you just said. I'm writing the introduction for this book, the second book. I always write the introduction last after I finish a book, and there's this great quote by Ken Wilber, you know, the integral philosopher, and I'm not going to get it, you know, exactly right just by saying it to you right now, but the gist was like, you know, there's three things I never write about. You know, one is God in the second person, which means, you know, talking about what I'm talking about, like a personal, intimate relationship, an experiential, you know, less theory, more just hands-on. Reincarnation, and then he says like psychic phenomena or something. He said, because if you do, you know, nobody in the academic world will ever take you seriously again.
Mm-hmm.
And I have that in my introduction because I'm like, check, check, check. Like, we're going there. And I think, you know, for, again, a recovering scholar, it was quite a struggle to allow this book to actually approach these subjects and to share more personally around
them. And to put your name on it.
And to put my name on it, you know. And it's something that it's seriously almost killed me. Like, it's been an intense process. But, you know, there is the honest scholar part of me that really is like, we got to share this stuff, you know, in like an intelligent way, because it's happening to all of us in our own unique ways. And to sort of hide it in the background and only say specific things, sometimes in this whole study and learning process, can really hinder us, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's a way to present it that's like candid. It's not trying to, it's not inflated. It's just sort of like, look, this is happening, and I am using every card in the deck to try to understand it and to be respectful, you know, towards all the religious traditions. But it gets to a point where you just are realizing the one you really have to be respectful to is your own soul and her connection with the divine. And so that has won out for me, you know, that connection. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when you have an experience that is undeniable, it shifts everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It takes it out of the realm of, you know, the dusty tomes and you know, and you were walking on new territory then, and you and how can you in your own integrity ignore what has happened or shifted within you, or how whatever language you want to use, you know, because you know what, to deny experiences like that is to deny her whatever she is, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, and that's a bigger sin, I think, than risking some ridicule from some stuffy old scholars who don't have the courage to, you know, maybe, who knows, you know, maybe they had experiences, but they just, you know, didn't have the courage to talk about it.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that.
Well,
you.
Sarah,
yeah.
You are awesome. And can I just ask you, how old are you? Do you mind me asking you?
No, I'm 35.
You're 35. Well, yeah. you are wise for your age. I wish I was as smart as you when I was 35. I really do. You are going to be so smart, so much wiser by the time you're 55 and then 75.
Oh, I can't wait.
Cuz you know what, you got so much of it already that so many people never ever get. So all right, so we, in the last couple minutes we have here, let's tell people about your retreats and your workshops and how they can find out more about you and your books.
Sure, thank you. I'm coming out of the Red Zone after, like I said, like my 2.5 year hiatus, and I am going to be holding the first, you know, Bay Area Redvolution workshop, and that's August 17th to the 19th, and I'm just really excited about it because I haven't done one in the Bay Area. I'm usually on the East Coast or at different spiritual centers, and this one just feels really good, especially since I've been sort of holed up in the tent for a while. And I also am offering a teleclass, and it's also the first one and probably the last one, on my first book, The Red Book, and that starts September 4th. And that's 5 weeks on Tuesdays, 5 p.m. West Coast time to 6:15 p.m. And everyone can find that information on sarahbeek.com. And that's SERABEAK.com, like a bird's beak. Yeah.
You know what? You are awesome. I love you. You are a woman after my own heart. I feel like you're my little sister, and I am just going to keep following your work, and maybe I'll even get your books. I just think you're delicious and juicy, and you know what? You are the future. I think the New York Times had it right.
Well, thank you so much, and I am such, now that I know your work, I'm such an admirer, and just thank you for what you're doing in the world and what you're offering all of us. It's really great to know you now.
Oh, well, thank you. We're all just doing our little part, and hopefully, you know, we'll put it all together and make this paradigm shift happen, and the world will be a better place.
Yes.
That's all we're trying to do.
I love it. Yeah.
Well, listen, you go back to your red tent and keep you know, cooking up the juicy stuff that you're doing there, and let's keep in touch, okay?
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed my two guests tonight. I think they have just been spectacular. And, you know, there's a few things I want to share with you before the end of the hour, because I promised. First, I want to tell you about an event that's coming up at the Goddess Temple of Orange County on July 1st. A wonderful friend of mine, priestess, Chris Oster, she is going to be given a presentation at the Goddess Temple of Orange County on July 1st. It's called The Power of Nine, Rebirthing Yourself and Your Business by Offering the World Your Goddess-Giving Gifts. And here's a little description. Know what you're passionate about and tell your story. Shout it from the rooftops. Creating sustainable happiness and wealth for ourselves at first seems self-indulgent and greedy, but the truth of the matter is you can't help anyone with your gifts if you're constantly worried about money and how you're going to pay the bills. Chris says, I look forward to sharing some of my mythic wisdom from Africa, Greece, and the UK to help you begin a creative, to create passive income and promote your gifts so that the people who need you the most can find you and your work. Chris Oster, she's a drummer, writer, marketing muse, creativity midwife, born to empower goddess entrepreneurs. And she said, in true form to my Renaissance soul, I believe all the twists and turns of your life's journey are sacred, and telling your unique story can bring in clients, customers, and magic. So you want to look into that if you're in Southern California for July 1st. And I'll mention it again in the shows leading up to July 1st if you want more information about that. I don't actually have Chris's contact information here in front of me, but if you want more info about that, get in touch with me and I will put you in touch with Chris, or just go to the Goddess Temple on July 1st and you will hear all about that, because Chris is just awesome. Also, too, I want to tell you about an annual event that I've been doing for the last 11 years. It's coming up again on July 15th. It's the Isis Birthday Salon and Feast. It's going to be held in Signal Hill. And it's that time of year again when we celebrate the annual Isis Birthday Salon and Feast. And this year's guests, they're going to be delighted by wonderful entertainers and enjoy a sumptuous catered feast of Turkish cuisine prepared by a Turkish chef, and inspired by the visiting Aphrodite and the Gods of Love exhibit at the Getty Museum in Malibu, and taking advantage of the comfort of our private space, the afternoon activities are going to include ritual, dancers, storytellers, enactments, music, drumming, dance. We will invoke both the essence of our beloved Isis, she of 10,000 names, for her birthday, and Aphrodite, goddess of love, beauty, and life, who hails from Aphrodisias, Turkey, asking that they share in the festivities and the fun. So I hope you'll join us for this annual celebration as we call upon these great mothers to journey with us in our annual celebratory ritual party. It's for women, men, and well-behaved older children. We have a delicious menu. It's $23.50 per person. If you want to reserve your spot, you can email me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. And before we run out of time, I want to share with you an email I got from Walter Schultz. He follows the show, and he communicates with me often via email and Facebook. You know, we've been talking about, you know, women rising up and changing the world. Well, you know, he's been listening to us and on our podcast last week. Well, I'll just read you the email. It's easier. Miss Tate, last podcast, Miss Silvermoon suggested a precipitous change occurring this month, followed by an ongoing follow-up change. Her word was relentless in describing it. This is due to the squaring of Pluto and Uranus following summer solstice and occurring after the Venus transit. There has been little coverage of what has been occurring in Quebec. Starting in February, because he was in Montreal at the time, there's an annual fun protest received a jolt. He says, I was in downtown Montreal at the time and saw a helicopter down the street hovering. I asked one of my colleagues who was having a cigarette outside at the time, and his response was, each year the students have a protest in the street on this day. Well, that night, he says, I was awoken in my hotel room by the sound of police sirens on several different occasions. The, quote, fun, unquote, protest was becoming serious. He says, I returned home a few days later and saw nothing of it in the American press. I can say there appears to have been a concerted blackout of this story in the American media. I can only assume it was hoped doing so would prevent it from spreading to the U.S. It's boiled over and has now made the front page of the BBC often, and just today has made it to the front page of MSNBC. It's been a continuous protest against austerity measures trying to be imposed by the Quebec government. The movement is only gaining ground. And a play on the French translation of Arab Spring, it is now being called the Maple Spring. If the protest against austerity ignites into protests further around North America, it may be a sigil raised for a more feminine-based social structure. Just wanted to pass this along. Again, thanks for the wonderful podcast. And Walter, thanks for sending this, because you know what? I you know, we never hear hear about the progressive rallies in the street. We, you know, of course we hear about the Tea Party. You know, we never hear about the stuff that's pro-women, pro-worker, pro-immigrant, you know, pro-gay rights. You know, those things are all always squashed in the news. And we certainly know that austerity measures are not helping out people in Western Europe. You know, they are going into a deep recession or a depression. And, you know, I'm ready. Somebody just needs to tell me when and where, because I will be in the streets, you know, fighting against austerity, fighting against the Ryan budget plan. There are enough people suffering in this country. The rich don't need to be richer. You know, it needs to be about the us and the we, you know, not the I and the me. So, Walter, thank you for that. And listeners, if ever you, you know, get wind of something that, you know, the corporate media is not sharing with us, please send it to me, and I will share it here. And again, Walter, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, next week on the show, I will be here on Tuesday, because I'm going to a fabulous Aphrodite event at the Getty Museum in Malibu. And if you've clicked the follow button, you'll get notice of the shows and you won't need these reminders. So on Tuesday, you'll hear from Sherry Richards. She's going to discuss her award-winning book, Dancing with Your Dragon. She'll teach us how to reclaim your personal power and learn to teach your inner dragon to dance. That sounds like fun. Then Alea Deo will talk about her meditations that speak to the heart and help us learn to honor the divine feminine as we move through the world. She'll help us learn to anchor more deeply into the divine feminine, all aspects of one's life. Later in the month, we have noted author Lynn Andrews discussing her newest book, Coming Full Circle, Ancient Teachings for a Modern World. William Kennedy will talk about the famous book by Robert Graves, The White Goddess, and his experience meeting Maria Gimbutas. Scholar Amy Levin will share her work tracing contemporary religious movements in American history and the intersection of liberal religion and feminism, including the Kabbalah. And so these are just a few peeks behind the June curtain. You won't want to miss another great month here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Oh, and if you didn't hear, in May, Voices of the Sacred Feminine has surpassed its last demographics. We have more listeners and more downloads than ever before. So listeners, thank you so much. I so love you. You are gas in my tank. You keep me going. And you know what? Thank you so much for taking your valuable time and listening to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. So have a wonderful week. May Goddess embrace you in her golden wings, and I will close with a prayer from the Goddess Temple down in Orange County. Great Goddess, living, moving, breathing, and eternally renewing woman throughout all time, whatever the many catastrophes befalling humanity, woman prevails and leads in beauty and power. We are grateful for the eternal divine female source that lives in each of us, giving us all we need to continue the human race, to continue our own experience of joy and renewal each year, each day, each moment. Blessed be. So to close the last few minutes of the show, because I have just a little bit more time, I'm going to let you listen to Abigail Spinner McBride, a wonderful artist out of Las Vegas, and I love this song of hers called Arms of the Mother. Thank you, listeners, so very much for your listener loyalty, for all your feedback, for just being there. Have a wonderful week. Have a wonderful weekend, and remember, tune in next Tuesday. Good night. Evil, mama.